Hi, welcome to Off Script. I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Today on the show, Carolina, Caroline. We missed this movie earlier this year. It's a road movie. It's a love story. It's a crime spree. Stars as Samara Weaving and Kyle Gallner. Really excited to talk about this. Caught this on VOD this week. Also going to take a look at The Sheep Detectives. Oh my God, did people tell us to watch this movie? People told us to watch this movie. It came out in theaters. We missed it. It's on Amazon Prime. You can watch it right now. We watched it. I'm very much looking forward to talking about this movie. Phil Lord and Chris Miller, executive produced this film. It stars Hugh Jackman, Julie Louis-Dreyfus, and it's about a bunch of sheep solving a mystery, right? It's a little Knives Out, a little Hot Fuzz, surprisingly, which is weird. Really looking forward to talking about Sheep Detectives. Stick around for the review. We're gonna talk about our top five of the year. Just some stuff that we liked, you know, that we've seen, that we enjoyed at the theater so far in 2026. You might be surprised. We got some similarities on there, but we break off in a couple places too. Fun conversation coming in the middle of the show. Before we get to all of it, we need to take a look at the news. Our first story this week, we have news about Heat 2. Which normally I wouldn't care much about, like, Heat 2, the sequel, but this kind of has some casting in it that I think cinephiles are really excited about. Two people you would think would have been in a film together, but actually haven't starred opposite one another. Who is going to be in Michael Mann's Heat 2, Andy?
Right, this is one of the biggest properties that's floating around in development. Every actor trying to be a part of. We have Christian Bale and Leonardo DiCaprio joining cast of Heat 2. DiCaprio is going to play the Val Kilmer character. He's the one that gets away at the end of Heat, kind of pays a great price for it. And then Christian Bale is playing the detective, originally played by Al Pacino in the first Heat. Incredible roles. Everyone is just cooking in that film. So it's really exciting. Yeah, and these two have never worked together. They've just never had a chance too. So really exciting acting powerhouses.
Yeah, Bale and DiCaprio is super exciting. Like, they're both tremendous. We're hearing Stephen Graham may have a part in this film as Neil McCauley, Robert De Niro role from the first film. Adam Driver is in talks to play the villain of this film. Not confirmed yet, but really exciting. A number of actresses have been vying for the role of Charlene, who's Ashley Judd's character. I just read something about Obsession star Indy Navarette met with Michael Mann recently following the success of the film. I was like, stick her in there. Absolutely. Why not? You know what I mean? Like, this seems to be shaping up to be a really hot property. I know there's a book that I think Michael Mann wrote a few years ago.
Yeah.
Right. And then the first I kind of heard of this, we heard some rumblings in the news a year or two ago about Heat 2 maybe shaping up into a project that maybe people would be interested in going to see if it would translate to theaters. We covered the first film on the pod. You can check out the review on YouTube and the website. But the first time I really heard about it in the wild, I was doing some work with a Navy SEAL, and he had a guest on his podcast who was another Navy SEAL who's done some film and video work for television, doing some consulting. And he was like, hey, I got to tell you about this thing. They're making a Heat 2 movie, and it's going to have, like, the best people ever. And I know 10 guys who are all military guys who are all trying to get on in consulting roles or to play henchmen or goons. And I was like, yeah, okay, sure, man. Yeah, all right, yeah. Like, I act, you know, yeah, that sounds great. But in my head, like, I don't know. That sounds a little facetious. We hear kind of movie news all the time. But this thing really seems to be shaping up into a big action hitter. Exciting, right? Bale and DiCaprio in a heist movie. I don't know. It could just be the greatest movie of all time. Like, really shaping up to be something special here. Do you think Michael Mann still has the heat? You think it's going to be good? Or do you think it's going to be like old hat?
Yeah, I think so. People forget the original Heat was actually written by Mann as a television pilot originally. It was going to be a TV show. It didn't get picked up. He rewrote it for the screen, and it ended up being this classic of crime and cops and robbers, and like there's a lot going on there. Now it's like it's an American classic, and so I think that this is going to have a lot of heat. He's got this incredible cast. They're talking about the action scenes are going to be John Wick times 1,000 is what they're saying. So they're really going to be big on the action scenes, and also the story will serve as both prequel and sequel. So we'll have things that happened before the events of the first film and also catching up with the surviving people afterwards. So I think that's a very interesting thing, a bit of a Godfather 2 approach to that. I think it's really exciting.
If you have the means, while this is coming together and things are happening, considering how popular like nostalgia theatrical releases are, re-releases are right now, there will almost assuredly be a screening of Heat coming to a theater near you sometime in the next year or two. You should go. Would recommend. That was the first time I'd seen it. We went to a theater and watched it. It hits. It slaps. It's great. I know it's a classic, but it plays great on the big screen. So if you have the means, check it out. Speaking of big screen happenings, Vin Diesel confirms that the last Fast and Furious movie is in production. It's happening. We have a video from his Instagram. I don't think I can play it because we'll get demonetized, but I can look at the article from Deadline. What do you know about it, Andy?
Right. So Vin Diesel, who he's always announcing things that aren't happening, but he swears for sure this time that the final Fast and Furious movie titled Fast Forever is supposed to come out March 17th, 2028, a little under 2 years from now, about 18 months from now. We'll see if this actually happens, because he's announced a whole lot of things in an effort to kind of pressure the studios. But Universal did announce and sign off that they were finally going to finish the second part of what was supposed to be a two-part finale. This is going to be like 5-6 years after that Fast 10 was released. And it's going to be funny if this movie still has juice. We also know that they're, Amazon is going to be doing a Fast and Furious TV show, which is probably a better place for these kind of what is now a nostalgia property. People will tune into to a show like that for sure.
It's so crazy. This movie is setting its premiere for March 17th, 2028. Like, over a year we got to wait. Like, I know y'all do a lot of VFX, but they're supposed to be bringing the budget down and shrinking it down and setting it in LA and bringing it back to its roots. And like, man, it's going to be a long wait, but it'll be cool at least to see it heading into summer, you know, a year and a half from now. I can't believe it's going to be nearly 6 years since the literal cliffhanger ending of the last film. Most people quickly reference, like myself on previous shows, that there is a child involved in that literal cliffhanger scene. That kid's going to be recast. Has to be recast,
kid's
I think.
Be, like, it's not, in college.
That kid's in college now. Yeah, right. That kid has a job and a family and a mortgage. Like, that's not going to work. So they're going to pivot. It's going to be fine. I think the answer is a time jump. That's how you cover that, right? Like, you just open the movie and it's like have a flashback to how they somehow solved that. CGI the kid's face or something, make it work. Bang, well, move us up into the modern.
The problem is that movie ends on a cliffhanger and there's like 5 storylines that are all on cliffhangers. So I don't think you can just be like, well, remember how we got out of that crazy situation? I don't think you can do that across 5 storylines. Because it was really built to like, oh, the next movie will pick up exactly where this one leaves off. So I think they got quite the challenge ahead of them.
NBC Universal is making 4 Fast and Furious TV shows. That's what they say, currently in development, between like a kid's show and then something they're going to do over on Netflix and probably some anime thing or something. Like, so there's definitely still some interest in the franchise. I guess people have not forgot. No, I take it back. I think people have kind of forgotten about Fast and Furious. They'll roll out a big campaign and they'll do this whole like the one last ride garbage, right? Like, get everybody in on it. Like, oh, you got to come see the last Fast and Furious movie. But like, it's so baffling that the same year that last Fast and Furious movie came out was the last Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1. And that was the other like action blockbuster Part 1 that came out that summer. And then just like a year later, we got Part 2. And that was it. It's wrap. Maybe 2 years? Like, maybe it was 2.
About a year and a half.
I think it was like a year and a half. And you got Part 2 and that was it. And we're wrapped up. And meanwhile, like, God, over half a decade, we had to wait between Fast and Furious movies. And Andy's right. Like, there's like 5 cliffhangers in the last one. It's so goofy. I love the idea that Vin Diesel's not actually on set, but he's secretly like at Universal Studios just filming on like the Fast and Furious ride like by like the prop car, and he's like, look, we're doing it, guys, like it's still just a fib, but like maybe I'm sure it's a real set, probably. I don't know what the deal is, but anyway, we'll keep it posted on Fast and Furious. It's the funniest thing in Hollywood. We gotta talk about Minions 3. Oh no, I'm sorry, this is the box office story. Minions did okay, I guess, for an animated film, but not for Minions, right?
Yes, Minions and Monsters had a 5-day, because this actually came out on Wednesday before the July 4th holiday, 5-day haul of $61 million, which is about half compared to the previous installment, Despicable Me 4, which opened to $120 million over the same long break. These films have historically just done huge amounts at the box office, and for some reason, which I don't really know enough about, but Minions and Monsters is not connecting with audiences. I thought this would for sure be as big as the other one. I think it's still doing pretty well for an animated film. It's going to make a decent amount of money, but compared to like the rest of the Minions franchise, it's not. It only made 36.4 million over the 3-day weekend, 160 million globally. So it is coming up a little short of expectations, but still doing pretty well.
I wonder if Hollywood will take the wrong lessons from this and blame it on like the subject matter. Like, okay, no more spinoffs from Despicable Me. It's just got to be Despicable Me 5, right? Because Despicable Me 4 came out just a couple years ago. So none of those. And also none of this weird Hollywood artsy crap, right? That's going on in Minions and Monsters. Like, that's the one thing I keep hearing about it is it's ode to old Hollywood. Yeah, exactly. And they're like, that's too complicated. We're overthinking it. Seems to be baby movies for babies. That's probably where these movies are headed. I don't know if we're getting another Minion spinoff, but they'll make another whatever. They'll make another something, I'm sure. Like, these things are too popular. Believe it or not, Sheep Detectives, I didn't know this. A director of Sheep Detectives, what's his name? Kyle something? He is a longtime Minions director. I didn't know that. Like, he did a bunch of these movies with Illumination. Did like Despicable Me 4 and 3, I think. And he took a break from those to make Sheep Detectives. So I know that's not what went wrong, but it's certainly a difference. So I don't know.
Toy Story 5 came in at number 2, another 31 million over the weekend, 764 million globally. This is going to be a billion-dollar film. It's racing to be the top film of the year so far. Not surprising. We knew that it was always going to do really well. But like I said, I thought Minions and Monsters would kind of do the same as Toy Story. So Toy Story 5 will continue to have good legs. We got to talk about Young Washington, which is a new film from Angel Studios that does all those kind of right-wing propaganda films. Came in with 20.8 million, no global release, domestic only, but that's number 3 at the box office. But we're a little suspicious of these numbers. Zach, get into that.
Yeah, so I don't have anything firm on this. But I was talking to Andy about it before the pod, and I was like, can I talk about this a little? Because I don't know if any of our listeners have heard this or seen this. I keep hearing that Angel Studios is goosing numbers, goosing their ticket sales. They're artificially inflating them. At the end of every Angel Studios project, at the end of every film, Sound of Freedom or Young Washington, whatever, whichever one you're watching, there's a QR code and like a prompt to go to a website and donate tickets. You can donate money and that will directly translate into ticket purchases for Angel Studios projects, right? Like, so if you like Sound of Freedom, you can go buy a ticket for somebody else. And you can donate in different amounts, and they have like incentives to donate to like a classroom full of school children, right? Whatever. And then you pair that donation prompt with like pictures of ushers on Reddit in like quote unquote sold out shows for Angel Studios projects like Young Washington that are empty and no one's in them. And it seems like Angel Studios is taking those donations, immediately transferring them to ticket sales if they can't get anybody to like take a free ticket. They're just buying tickets in empty theaters in the middle of the day. And that translates to a big splashy opening. And it's like getting donations from people who have already seen the film. And I'm just perplexed by it. I think maybe we've talked about it on the pod before. And like, again, there's no like firm, Variety has not done a story. Washington Post doesn't have like a scoop. There's no exclusive. Nobody knows anything for sure, but it's just odd. And I don't know if I know other films that have done this, that have prompted like the movie, buy a ticket for somebody else, and it works. So when I see big openings for Young Washington, I know it came out on Independence Day. Andy's right. It's got a political lean. There are people out there who will go see this no matter what. I get that, right? There's a bit of religion tied in there. Pro AI people are going to see this thing because there's some of that in that movie. Like, I get it. I just don't, I wish I could get a better picture of like what the actual cultural impact is versus like, haha, we opened third in the United States. And it's like, well, yeah, but you bought a bunch of your own tickets with like, I don't know. It's confusing. That's what I got. There's not a lot to it. Call it Zach's Conspiracy Corner or something. But Angel Studios, they're doing some funny math happening behind the scenes, I worry.
Yeah, it can't be trusted. And if you're interested in what this film is about, it's about a young George Washington, or younger, and his exploits in the French and Indian War in the 1750s. It does have some star power in it. Mary Louise Parker's in it, Kelsey Grammer, Andy Serkis, Ben Kingsley, people looking for paychecks. It's tough in Hollywood. Everyone's got to get paid. Moving on to number four at the box office, Supergirl came in with a number 9.6 million, 100 million globally, a steep nearly 80% decline in its second week. Real bad. We got to talk about Supergirl. There's a lot going on here. There was this big article that came out talking about lots of trouble behind the scenes, competing cuts, no one happy with either cut of the film, competing musical tastes. Zach knows a little bit more about this than I do.
Yeah, Hollywood Reporters published this story on the 3rd, just before July 4th. Behind the Supergirl bomb, competing cuts, creative differences is exclusive. At least it was till they published it. Now we're talking about it here. Yeah, so it turns out they've got some insider reports that there was a lot of friction behind the scenes on Supergirl, specifically between director Craig Gillespie and James Gunn and Peter Safran, who are kind of the dual studio heads of the new DC studios, right? So far, those two have only made one film, Superman, and this is kind of their follow-up, and they contracted it out. They got Craig Gillespie making it. James Gunn isn't taking the reins on it, but it turns out they wanted a bit more creative control than maybe they got with Craig. And during some test screenings, they found that the film kind of wasn't working earlier in production. So they reshaped some things and tried to move some stuff around. Gunn suggested a different ending song for the big needle drop at the end of the movie, a Jimmy Eat World track that people have been memeing on since it came out. And ultimately, things come to a head in March when it's revealed that Gunn and Co. have hired Gunn's longtime editor, the guy who cut Guardians of the Galaxy, the guy who cut Superman, also did some work for Quentin Tarantino, to effectively recut Craig Gillespie's footage. They recut Supergirl, and it's like 12 minutes longer or shorter. I don't recall whose cut is which. They screen both of them against one another, which is nuts. Warner Brothers did the same thing to George Miller when on Mad Max Fury Road. It's nuts. They literally made a second cut of it and screened it with two test audiences room to room. And whoever turned out the better scores, that's the one we're putting in theaters. It is the most bonkers strategy. It's disgraceful to do to a filmmaker. This is what they do to Craig Gillespie. They make a second cut of Supergirl using his footage. They run it in theaters and they decide, you know what, Craig, our scored a few points higher. We're putting the studio cut of Supergirl in theaters, and that is what you and I all watched. What is in theaters right now is not Craig Gillespie's cut of Supergirl. It's theirs. Now, it's mostly the same. They do say in here that it's not that different, that ultimately it's the same footage either way, right? So yeah, you can tweak some colors and you can change some music and you can tweak when you cut, but ultimately it's mostly the same movie. But even still, this movie is flopping, and now that's getting hung on Craig Gillespie, right? Because they're not saying, oh, that's our studio cut. We jumped in at the last minute and did that. Nope, that just all looks like a Craig Gillespie picture. And I think that's real harrowing for talent to work with DC Studios. Like, this is kind of their second feature out the gate. A lot of directors are skeptical of working in superhero movies. I don't see Curry Barker making a superhero film anytime soon. I can't imagine our obsession director is Curry Barker. Kane Parsons is going to do one. Like, I think people are already wary of making superhero movies, and now DC Studios is building a name for, hey, if this doesn't work, we're hanging you out to dry and we're going to make you hold the bag. And I think that sucks, and that's no good. Maybe it's nothing, but Supergirl is not working, and it seems like they knew it behind the scenes and they just could not come to a good conclusion.
Right. Supergirl doesn't work for a number of reasons. We pointed out, like, I'm a huge fan of comic books, and I've read the comic that it's based on, and it absolutely didn't work for me. The story's all over the place. It can't decide what kind of movie it wants to be. There's two protagonists. It's a bad script overall, and that affects everything else going on there. I think, again, I said that Millie Alcock, I think, is really good. It makes you question, like, maybe she should have had a TV series and we should have had a Green Lantern movie instead of the opposite, which is what we're getting this summer. I mean, it's hard to know. There's also things like changing audience tastes. The younger generations, they're not interested in superhero stuff anymore. The reason millennials were so big on it is because we grew up in the 90s watching these animated TV shows like X-Men and Batman the Animated Series, and that's where we saw our superheroes, and then it was really exciting when they got turned into feature films. But Gen Z and Gen Alpha, they've grown up with, you know, superhero fatigue, with these movies all around them, so they're just not really interested. They're like, that's my dad's stuff. And I think Kane Parsons actually asked, does he want to do a Star Wars movie? And he was like, absolutely not. Like, they don't care about these older properties. So, like, I think just that superhero films are falling out of fashion a little bit isn't helping. But at the end of the day, it's a bad movie, and it's hard to save a bad movie.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And it's a bummer it's bombing. I was hoping for better. I'm very curious to see what happens to Clayface. I'm a little worried it's already starting to slide down a similar tube, but it's a horror film, right? It's different. It's going to kind of maybe be in the vein of what Matt Reeves is doing over with Batman. Batman is wildly popular in the comics. Like, it is a different thing. And I can't say for sure what's going to happen. So that's Supergirl. It's really a bummer.
Yeah, I think the big test for James Gunn is going to be the next feature film next summer, Man of Tomorrow, the follow-up to the Superman movie. That is going to be, you know, Gunn's thing. He's in the director's chair and the writer's chair, and that's going to have our main superhero. So if you can make the main superheroes work, I think he'll be fine. If that movie bombs or isn't good or poorly written or any of those things that are plaguing Supergirl, I think he's going to be in real trouble.
One more footnote before we wrap up the box office. From this story, there's word that if this WB Paramount merger goes through, James Gunn is out at DC, which is nuts because they just put him in there. And like, that would be a wild move to just rip him right back out of it and be like, haha, just kidding. But changes in leadership make big decisions. So I don't know how Paramount feels about James Gunn. I'm sure he has some opinions they don't like. I don't know, man. I don't know. That would be crazy. I don't know how much credence there is to give that.
I think that studios need to recognize that, you know, what Kevin Feige did in the 2010s with the MCU was kind of a flash in the pan. Everything was perfect. Market conditions were perfect for that 10-year run of success. And you're not going to be able to replicate it. Like, you could, I don't care who you get in charge of DC, you're never going to recreate like what the MCU had, that run. I think we're at a place where you can make big mainstream superhero films, Batman, Superman, Spider-Man, X-Men, but the days of, you know, making Thor 2 and making $500, $600 million are over.
Yeah, at least at the, seemingly at the movies. Meanwhile, God, you could make $400 million on Obsession, which is nuts. I read that just broke some other fat record this week as like the highest grossing live action under $1 million ever or something. Like, just crazy success.
Right. Obsession finally out of the top five, just crossed $400 million internationally, again, setting records everywhere. And again, it's people keep seeing it. It's out on VOD now, and people are still going to see it in the theater. Same thing with Backrooms, which is now crossed $350 million internationally. I went and actually watched the new version that has an extra 15-minute video at the end, which is kind of in the style of the YouTube videos, the Everything Must Go edition. Some fun stuff, really kind of scary. I was surprised. I was mad because the jump scares got me in the new additional footage. A lot of fun, especially for you lore heads that if you've been following the Backrooms YouTube stuff, you'll really like. But I think overall it showed me like why Kane Parsons got to do this movie. Like, he really does have an eye behind the camera and for building tension and for good scares.
Yeah, I'm really excited to check it out. I'm not going to go see it in theaters, but I'm sure it'll come to home video at some point, and I'll watch it there. I feel like I have seen so many cam rips of Backrooms online, and I know it dumps on VOD tonight, July 7th, 7-7 is when it hits VOD, and you can at least get it. But oh my God, like, I've seen clips and memes and screenshots and AI-enhanced screen caps of people in theaters taking photos. Like, dude, Backrooms and Obsession has been... Maybe the biggest story of the summer is the success of these two films. You know, I know we got a lot of summer to go, but like, good God, like, they are just absolute titans. We're going to talk about our top five of the year here in a minute. You're going to see these films come back around. So, yeah. Anything else before we jump into Caroline?
I mean, not just the biggest of the summer. Those two movies are going to be like the biggest box office stories of the year. Just so wildly successful. And it's not just the money. It's a shift in audience taste. It's showing that Gen Z does want to go to the movies. They will go for the right things, but they want to go for stuff that is for them and that they grew up with, not old millennial superhero stuff. It shows a real shift in taste and also exciting new young directors. We don't get a lot of that very much these days. So I think there's a lot here behind just the numbers.
I'm so curious to see if Oscar voters, especially the older ones that have been in the Academy for a long time, will hold their nose and vote for these films. Because I know they don't normally go for real young Maverick stuff like this, but then again, look at the success of Daniel's Everything Everywhere All at Once, right? Like, a wild production from a couple of music video directors on a shoestring budget that turned out at a huge number of awards, right? Maybe they'll go for this stuff. Maybe we see Backrooms catching a production design nod. Like, I don't know. But I think you're right. Like, I think 2026, we're going to look back and think, man, these two movies really just did something special together. A 1-2 punch. Anything else in the box office where we jump into,
Let's get it moving.
Let's do it. Andy's going to be taking the summary on this, so I'll get out of his way. Andy, please take it away.
Carolina, Caroline. So this is a new romance action crime drama from director Adam Raymeyer, who previously did Dinner in America, which is a movie I haven't seen, but I've seen like kind of float up and people bring up in on Twitter, a film Twitter conversation. So this is a follow-up to that. It had a very brief theatrical release and is now available on VOD. It stars Samara Weaving and Kyle Gollner. It takes place in the, I think, late 80s, early 90s, pre-cell phone era. We meet Samara Weaving's Caroline in this one-horse town, kind of doing nothing with her life, but she has a criminal meet-cute with Kyle Gollner's Oliver. She catches him running a con in the local gas station, filling station, calls him out on it, and they meet up and have a little bit more conversation, get to know each other. And turns out she's just, wanting to get out of this one horse town, but doesn't know how. It's all she's ever known. And he's a bad boy driving a Camaro, this muscle car kind of promises her the world. She's now interested in finding her estranged mother who lives in Carolina. It starts out, they start out in Texas, just for orientation. So they meet, they fall in love, and they hit the road. And she knows from the outset that he's a con man, that he's not a good guy. And they have a great conversation. She keeps asking him what he does, and he goes, "You know what I do." And then it's a great stuff. That, like I said, it's a good romance. And then they hit the road for a life of petty crime. Their cons get bigger and bigger. They eventually turns into bank robberies. But like all crime films of this kind of Bonnie and Clyde style, it has to end in tragedy. Lots to talk about here. Fun little movie. Zach, what'd you think?
So I didn't really know what to expect about this movie. I had heard it was getting a bit of buzz online, but I didn't hear a big splash from friends or anything. Not like Sheep Detectives, which we're going to talk about here in just a little while, which I felt like I heard about from everybody in my life. This one kind of flew under the radar a little bit, so I'm glad we got to catch it on VOD. It's a fun road movie, and Weaving and Gollner are kind of electric. Like, effectively, they're what makes this work. They're both wonderful. Gollner needs more work. Like, really, my man. The biggest things I think he's been is the Smile movies. And this movie called Dinner in America, which came out in 2020, which actually came from this director, Adam Raymeyer. He made that movie in 2020. In 2024, Raymeyer made a movie called Snack Shack with Gabriel LaBelle, who played young Steven Spielberg in Meet the Fablemans, that kid, right? Just the Fablemans. But then he's made this movie now, this kind of road movie. And I like what's happening here, but admittedly, I did find myself feeling like it was starting to fall into these ruts of films that I had seen before, especially on the pod. I thought of that movie, Bones and All, right? Starring Timothée Chalamet, a Luca Guadagnino film, which is another kind of road movie through like the Southeast. That's got a little bit more bloody and gory than what's going on here. This is different. This is kind of a con thing, and this is Southern, and it's got a twang, and it's got a lot of great needle drops. But I feel like I guess I thought it was going to be more than it was, and it ends up being kind of a humble feature about these two sort of Bonnie and Clyde characters. So solid. I think I was overhyped. Like, I thought bigger things were going to happen by the end. You know what I mean? It felt like it was all building to something greater. So
our performances are top notch. Like, Samara Weaving, who's from Australia, does a really good Southern accent, and same thing with Kyle Gollner. Like, they're both bringing like their A game to these roles, and it's very sweet, and it has some very touching moments. Unfortunately, the script and story just ends up being really cliche. It starts off so strong, where they're talking about like their dreams of going elsewhere in the world, and kind of this midlife ennui that they're both experiencing, and she's got this whole family backstory subplot and that she wants to explore. Am I just as bad as my mother who left? And then it just falls into every crime film you've ever seen, where of course the the crimes get bigger, they get more dangerous, someone gets hurt, they're eventually on the lam, and you've seen 100 movies like that. And it doesn't, it stops exploring those themes that it originally starts with, the stuff that's real interesting, and then like the mother subplot doesn't come, it disappears for an hour and then it comes back kind of at the end. And I was like, oh, I completely forgot about that. So unfortunately, like, while we have these two stars and this great, I love the look of this film. Like, it captures that 90s look of like cars and the money and all that stuff really well. But yeah, it's just, it's very cliche after about halfway through.
It feels really good to see an actor and an actress who I think have so much talent and who so often get kind of trapped in B roles or smaller films, like maybe supporting stuff. It feels so good to see them at the front and being great at it. Like, Gallner is hypnotizing as this kind of like man from nowhere who like seems to know all of this, how to kind of con people and rob people. And as he teaches Weaving's character, like Caroline, Oliver and Caroline are their names, as he teaches Caroline like how to do this stuff and pickpocket people and things start to escalate, like there's a real pleasure to it. As they're getting to know each other, right? Their feelings are growing, their scores are getting bigger. You get these wonderful montages of them set to this like wonderful blues country music. I love how this movie feels. And I like that it takes it serious. It knows when to hit the brakes when it's supposed to. Because obviously things are getting more serious. We're doing bigger crimes. We're starting to see wanted posters of us around town. You know, what are we going to do, Oliver? The first time you see a gun pulled on somebody in this movie, there's absolutely no music. It is silent. It is like deadly serious. It is a gun in somebody's face. And it is quiet and it's dramatic and it is meaningful. And then almost every time you see it for the next two-thirds of the movie, there's music and it's bouncy and it's fun and it's action. And then towards the end, as things get serious again, that starts to get pulled back out and it starts to be like, hey, this is real stuff. We are not just having this can't just be a movie. You know what I mean? Like, this has to go somewhere. There has to be an ending to this journey. And that stuff, I think, is good and dramatic where it needs to be. The action's fun where it needs to be. But yeah, like, it's hard not to think of films like Hell or High Water, right? Which like just gets this just a little bit better. It gets it just, I don't know what it is exactly. It turns the screws just a little tighter and it manages to work just a little smoother than Carolina Caroline. This is a lot of fun. Maybe it's the love in the middle of it. Maybe it's the love story. I don't know.
Well, like the horror genre, you use the genre to say something about society or your characters, or, you know, you think of the great crime films like Scarface or Goodfellas. Or again, this reminds me a lot of Hell or High Water. Those movies are saying things about our characters or about our current society, like the American Dream, those sorts of things. And this is, like I said, it starts that way and then it just doesn't really go anywhere. Even with our romance, we start off with this real interesting meet cue and they hit it off and they're totally into each other. And then like their relationship just doesn't really develop once they start criming. Because it's just doing the crimes. They're not learning more about each other as people or growing as a couple. It just kind of, all of a sudden, our relationship goes on pause while we do the crime spree part, the Bonnie and Clyde part. And so, again, we're not developing the romance very much either, which is a shame because, like I said, like they're acting their faces off. They're so good on camera. It's just the script isn't interesting enough.
Speaking of good on camera, there are no small parts. Kira Sedgwick is in this film in exactly one scene, and she's so great, dude. She needs to act more. I know she's kind of like semi-retired or whatever, but like she's tremendous as this kind of drifter character who ends up coming in later in the film. Just wonderful. I think she is so great as this kind of twisted person who's older and has been down that road and has seen the things you've seen and can tell you that things are not going to get better for you, girl. Kind of fantastic. And as things start to swell between Caroline and Oliver and things begin to come to a head, like it becomes all too obvious that like the dream's got to end, right, in one way or another. Kind of a special movie. I get also why I didn't hear too much about it. Like, it seems to land in this space where like it is cool at what it does. I've just maybe seen it done better in recent memory. Difficult to recommend, I guess. But any other thoughts or recommendations?
I'm ready.
Andy, would you recommend Carolina Caroline?
This is perfect for streaming, which is where it's available. It's available on VOD. It's a fun little crime movie, and we have really good performances from our leads. Unfortunately, it falls into very common cliched territory of crime films that you've seen before. You kind of know where it's going to go all along the way. But it's a fun little ride.
Yeah, I think I'm in the same boat. Carolina Caroline is a lot of fun, and it's a good time. It is currently on VOD for $10. I don't know if I would spend $10 on watching this movie. But when it comes to streaming, it's something you already pay for, totally throw this on. Absolutely. Like, if it's a subscription you're already in, Netflix, Prime, HBO, whatever, throw on Carolina Caroline. Solid. Solid road movie. Again, Kyle Gallner and Samara Weaving rock. They both need more work. They're both tremendous. Put these people in more movies soon. They're really good. And I'm kind of looking forward to what Adam Raymeyer does next as well. A fun indie road flick. That's Carolina Caroline. Andy, we're going to talk about top five of the year so far. I think I have a bumper for music for this, but do you want to bring us in and I can make it fancy and post?
sure thing. Top five of the year so far. So we've just hit July. We just had celebrated the July 4th holiday weekend. We're halfway through the year, and we wanted to take a look back through at the box office and the films so far. Think through the films that we've loved, that we've liked, that we haven't liked, and all that. And maybe talk a little bit about TV at the end as well. But so we're going to be doing our top five so far, and we'll get into it. We should have discussed how we're going to do this.
good news, listeners, you're in good hands. Andy and I have been doing this a long time. We are very good at doing lists on air. So we got this in the bag. But really quick, how do you want to do this? You want to do you first and then me, or what's...
You go first. You go first.
Should I just do my five? What are we...
Just do your number five.
Okay. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. All right, yes, my number five, my fifth favorite film of the year so far. Normally we do a top 10 at the end of the year, so if you're enjoying this, just wait till the end of the year, and also maybe check out previous year. My number five is The Furious. We saw this film just a few weeks ago. Kind of an unexpected thriller, a foreign language film out of some part of Asia, where it's got a bunch of guys beating the hell out of people, kung fu style. A father's daughter goes missing. He has to find her. It's effectively the plot of Taken, but it's from an entirely different part of the world where I do not see many stories. Using a language that I do not see expressed often in film, brutal physical violence. Not not on a big budget either, so you pretty much just got to make the choreography look good, and the choreography is so good. This is one of the most kinetic action films of the year, maybe of the decade. The Furious kind of rips, and if you haven't had a chance to see it, I'd encourage you. I think it's coming to VOD soon, if it's not already still in theaters. Furious is really great. That is my number five.
Right, and The Furious is actually my number four. Really enjoyed it. Again, top-notch action, martial arts. We haven't had a film like this in a long time. Excited to see. Again, it's a quick 100 minutes, and it's just action all the time. Doesn't slow down at all. So that was my number four. My number five, backing up one, is Wuthering Heights, which was a bit of a surprise, even to me. This is Emerald Fennell's adaptation of the Bronte novel, which starred, of course, Margot Robbie and Jacob Elordi, and was a huge hit. And I ended up really liking this adaptation. It is not period accurate at all. It's kind of dreamy. It's got a wonderful score, which I've listened to. I've added it to the soundtrack playlist. Really liked it. That's my number five. Zach, any thoughts on Wuthering Heights?
I like Wuthering Heights just fine. I think that movie, it's hard to believe that movie came out this year, because I associated it in my head with like winter and kind of, I don't know, the prestige films of late last year. But you're right, that is a mention this year. That might end up making my list later down the line. My number four is Project Hail Mary, which we covered on the pod here as well. Ryan Gosling plays Ryland Grace, an astronaut who is far from home and does not have the means to get back when he meets an unlikely companion in an alien named Rocky, who may just be able to help him solve how he got so far away from Earth and find a solution on how to get back. It is executive produced by Chris Lord and Phil Miller. Phil Lord and Chris Miller, actually. Phil Miller would be an awesome name. Those two guys from the Lego Movie and the Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse films. Really, it's directed by them, more importantly. It's the first feature in a minute, first live action in a minute. Really unique, big budget. I think this will get some awards attention come the end of the year. We'll see, though. I don't know if it'll end up staying on my top 10. I think it'll probably stay low like this, because my top three here, like yours, are pretty firm. I feel pretty good about the top three. What's your number three?
Real quick on Project Hail Mary, that's probably going to go on my honorable mentions. I liked it. There's a lot going for it, but I think there's a lot better films. But it will be wildly popular, I think, come awards season. My number three is Kane Parsons' Backrooms, or just Backrooms. Really enjoyed this film. I've seen it three times in theaters, and I don't know anything about the Backrooms. I didn't know, hadn't watched the YouTube series, didn't know anything about it. But I really enjoyed it. It's just a really creepy, get under your skin kind of movie. I think, again, it's exciting to have a young director be allowed to bring his vision. That's my number three.
Yeah, Andy and I are going to be trading blows here in the top three, but that's fine. My number three is Obsession. Curry Barker's recent feature has just blown box office records out of the water. It is the highest grossing live action film for under $1 million since like Bruce Lee's Enter the Dragon in the 70s. It blew Sinners out of the water for its budget versus like production, whatever, money it made back. It stars Indy Navarrete as a young girl, Nikki, who is wished upon, we'll say, by her suitor Bear, who likes her a lot and really wants her to like him back, so he wishes on a one wish willow cursed object, and surprise, she loves him but can't get rid of him. If you're listening to this, it has been a worldwide phenomenon. It feels silly for me to have to try to explain it here on the pod. Obsession has been wildly popular, and it's not only because it is cool and appeals to a younger demographic, but because it's a well-made movie, and it's done cheaply too, by a lot of young folks who are really hungry for work. Really special. Obsession's really cool. I'm really glad we got to watch it. I probably would have missed it if we hadn't done the pod, if we weren't doing the pod. So I'm glad I caught it. My number three. What do you got?
I was going to say, I recently just rewatched Obsession because it's on VOD now, and really liked it. You catch a lot of stuff second time around. I think it is a new classic, a masterpiece of horror, and it's going to be it's the biggest box office story of the year so far. So really great film. My number two is The Drama, which of course stars Zendaya and Robert Pattinson as a couple about on the verge of their wedding day when something strange comes out about the bride, about her past, and kind of throws everything into question, their relationship with their friends. This has been one of those movies that just generates so much chatter online and brings up a lot of interesting questions. I forget the name of the director. He previously had done a Dream Scenario with Nicolas Cage, but this is one of my favorites of the year. Really fun movie, and which asks a lot of kind of difficult questions about forgiveness and the society we live in now, and just it's phenomenal. It's a phenomenal film, and that's my number two.
Director of The Drama is Christopher Borgli. I also forgot. Thank you. I had to go look it up, but yeah, solid. Christopher Borgli directed that movie. We'll remember in the future because his name's going to keep coming up, I think. My number two is Nirvana, the band, the show, the movie. I didn't expect for this to be one of my favorite films of the year. I wasn't even sure it came out this year, but it did. It came out in early February. That's when it came out. So it counts. It's in 2026. One part's Jackass. One part's Back to the Future. And one part's like a couple of goofy friends with home video cameras just trying to make each other laugh. You get a film that is a buddy comedy time travel romp when two Canadian friends, Matt and Jay, are unexpectedly transported back to 2008 and have to figure out how to get back to their own time here in 2026. It's pop culture. It's funny. It's goofy. You don't have to have seen the original web series to get what it is. And it feels honest, earnest, and genuine in a way that sounds so schmaltzy to say, in a way that I don't see at the theaters. Planting your flag in the idea of making goofy stuff with your friends, which in a lot of ways is kind of exactly what Obsession is. It's a bunch of young folks who work together, like making stuff that they like. And that movie is cool. It makes me laugh. That's my second favorite film of the year. Number ones, Andy, what do you got?
We've just discussed this, but Obsession, my number one of the year. Thought a lot about this. I remember when I saw it, and I'm so glad that I saw it on opening night because I got ahead of everyone and I was like, Zach, this is incredible stuff. Got ahead of all the hype and just was blown away when I first saw it. Couldn't stop thinking about it. I've seen it again. There's been nonstop online discussions about it. It's made a star out of its leads, Indy Navarrete and Michael Johnston, who he's incredible in this as well. You know, bringing up difficult issues about modern young relationships, and just there's so much going on while still being a very scary horror. I've seen it and it still scared me the second time around. So really love it. Hope they get some awards attention. Obsession, my number one.
It's funny. I didn't see Obsession till like Sunday, I think. Opening weekend, I imagine, yeah, you must have just been floating, walking out of the theater opening night, and like, oh my God, like everybody is about to find out about this thing that I just saw, you know, like you're still right in front of it. Seeing movies opening night rocks. My number one is The Backrooms. I know we already talked about this. Like I said, Andy and I were trading blows earlier. It's been so long since I feel like I've seen a horror movie that just puts the horror right in front of you. It's well lit, even. It's not hiding in the dark. It's not keeping things in shadows so you can't see them. Like, it very earnestly is presenting horror in a strikingly different format that we don't get to see, like this crazy liminal space. Exit 8 almost made this list, and if Backrooms hadn't existed, that maybe it would have. Like, maybe that would have kind of slid into this place, but Backrooms is just perplexing, and I can't wait to watch it again. I haven't gone to see it again like Andy has. He's seen it a couple times. But I'm really looking forward to hitting VOD so I can watch it at home once or twice and just kind of seep in it again. Because whenever you're down there, like when you're in this place, it's genuinely magical in a way that like only the movies, I feel like, can take you. That's our top five of the year so far, right? We got more to go, of course. I think, man, I guess I want to know, Andy, what do you anticipate? Any that you think are going to come up that are going to slide in here? Probably Werewolf. Right, from Robert Eggers, come Christmas Day, probably get an odd slide in.
Well, next week we have the big one. Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey is, of course, probably the most anticipated thing. We also have Dune 3 at the very end of the year, Avengers Doomsday. I'm not looking forward to that, but that's going to be one of the big ones of the year. A lot of people are looking forward to that. Can't really think of the fall slate. There's a bunch of small stuff from Cannes that we haven't seen. Fjord. And all the awards contender stuff as well that usually hits this fall. Digger, which is the Tom Cruise new film that is probably going to win him an Oscar, despite him having won an honorary one last year. So still plenty of time left in the year.
That reminds me, have you seen, I probably should have talked about this in Trailer Park at some point, but it's fine. Did you see that new trailer for Digger, which is just a Tom Cruise montage for 3 minutes?
And then, I purposely didn't watch it because that's what it was. Dude, it didn't show anything new.
It is so gas. It's crazy. He's the greatest of all time. Like, I caught it in theaters because, yeah, I kind of didn't want to watch it online and then ended up seeing it in front of something. And, like, it is bonkers that it is just an advertisement for Tom Cruise's career followed by 30 seconds of Digger footage you've already seen and then a logo. And it's like, what? That is the oddest shaped trailer. I think they really want it to be like Cruise is entering his next era or something. This is his thing. It's like they want it to be Oscars, and I've still barely seen anything for the movie. Like, crazy. I hope Digger rocks. Yeah, I think there's a lot to look forward to this year. 2026 has kind of been an incredible one at the movies. So thank you for watching movies with us. And, you know, keep it here for more. Come the end of the year, we'll do this again. But for now, I got to talk about one more film. We got to wrap up this pod. We can get through this. Oh, yeah. We're going to do quick summaries. I forgot. Yes. Andy. How do we do this?
Well, just to recap our top fives, because we've talked about a lot of films. Want to make sure we get our list correct. So my top five films of the year so far are Wuthering Heights, The Furious, Backrooms, The Drama, and Obsession at number one.
Fantastic. I got The Furious, number five, Project Hail Mary, number four, Obsession, number three, Nirvana, The Band, The Show, The Movie, number two, and Backrooms is a sneaky number one that I did not expect. Love that movie. Very cool. It's a great year at the movies. Things are going great. It's great. And keep hearing off script for more. Okay, we got to talk about Sheep Detectives. I'm really excited to talk about this movie. I feel like I've had so many people tell me to check it out. It is not what I expected. It is something unique and special and different and feels like a movie we would have got 20 years ago at the movies. So with that, let's jump into The Sheep Detectives. So The Sheep Detectives is a 2026 mystery comedy feature starring a bunch of sheep, of course, who are all tragically CGI. I wish they had been real sheep, but I think that would have been messy. Film centers around George, a farmer, a sheep farmer specifically, played by Hugh Jackman, who lives in the English countryside, tends to his flock, lives in a little RV, loves his life, reads whodunit mysteries to his flock every night, even though he knows he can't understand them, although it turns out secretly they can. And they are learning how to solve a whodunit mystery. And unexpectedly, one morning, they find out that their farmer, George, the shepherd, has passed away. He's died. And it seems like everything's laced up and it's natural causes until Lily, the smartest of the sheep, played by voiced by Julia Louis-Dreyfus, figures out that it's not so. And something's wrong with George and the shepherd. And this whole thing smells of something's afoot. So she teams up with some of the other sheep. We get some supporting actors and actresses there. Bryan Cranston is one of the sheep. Patrick Stewart, Chris O'Dowd from the IT Crowd, if you remember that show. Rhys Darby is a sheep. Along with some locals and a bumbling police officer played by Nicholas Braun. And we have a whodunit. Who can solve the mystery of the dead shepherd and hopefully save the flock from outright devastation? Big supporting cast, big ideas, and executive produced by Chris Miller and Phil Lord, who we just talked about with Project Hail Mary. That is The Sheep Detectives. Andy, what'd you think?
So I've heard a lot of buzz about this too. It's done really well. It's made $120 million globally for this, like, fun little film. It's funny to say, I think this was a little overhyped for me because I had heard that it was really good. And I think it is a good film. I think this is a great film for people who don't go to the movies very often. You need something to take grandma to. You need something to take your 10-year-old or your 8-year-old who's never been to the movies before. Safe, fun film. But it does a good job of, you know, it's the whodunit genre, and it does a good job of explaining that, oh, in a whodunit, this happens. We have a crime, we have a motive, we have suspects. And so the movie's like instructing you how to watch it as you're watching it, which I think is really good for young viewers. And it also, it's funny, it's sweet. It also gets surprisingly serious in parts. There's a part where Bryan Cranston's doing his backstory and he's like, oh yeah, I was forced to fight in Sheep Fight Club in this carnival. And, you know, they're slaughtering sheep next door at the, you know, Sheep Holocaust is going on in the field next. So it just jumps tonally sometimes. But we have a star-studded cast as well that I wanted to read off. Hugh Jackman, of course, Brett Goldstein. Most of these are voices. Patrick Stewart, Regina Hall, Bella Ramsey, Chris O'Dowd, Rhys Darby, Bryan Cranston, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Nicholas Galitzin gets some time in there, Hong Chow. So it's like a who's who. Emma Thompson doing a great British bit as she's prone to do. So it's an all-star cast, both behind the mic and on screen. So it's a charming, fun little film. It's not quite the masterpiece that I had heard, but it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think Sheep Detectives is a little bit about seeing the bigger potential in others, like whether that be like the bigger potential for a scandal or maybe like the bigger potential in character and what a person or a sheep could be capable of in the future. It turns out George has a bit more than just being a shepherd. He actually has an inheritance, $30 million, believe it or not, because he invented and patented a special medicine for sheep that comes up in the film. It's very relevant. It's the blue kind of paste stuff that you see on Hugh Jackman's hands. And that inheritance is kind of the lead-in for our whodunit, right? Who murdered the shepherd? There's a few suspects around town. They all kind of look very almost like dollhouse figurines. They're very particular and have their own silhouettes. Here we have our goofy police officer played by Nicholas Braun. We have our out-of-town reporter who's just looking for a good story so he can finally get his break in reporting, and Nicholas Galitzin, hot off the set of He-Man. They try so hard to hide his arms in this. It's great.
Yeah,
he wears this huge, like, big puffy coat. It's really funny. Keep an eye out for Nicholas Galitzin in this movie. Emma Thompson shows up as this delightful purple-clad lawyer.
Like Clue.
Yes. Yeah. You get all your people, right? So you got to solve this thing. And you're in this wonderful English countryside town that feels right out of Edgar Wright's Hot Fuzz. Like the same sort of setup is like Nicholas Angel arriving in, I can't even remember the town they're in that movie. And yeah, you get all these little people, these little brownstone cottages and beautiful fields rolling off in the end. It's funny because it has to do all of that and also be a kind of compelling whodunit, and then also take the perspective of sheep. Got to do both. It has to be a heavy CGI animated feature. And so they got the perfect guy to make this movie. His name is, I got it right here, Kyle Balda, who I don't know, but he is an Illumination director from Illumination Studios. He did a few of those Despicable Me movies. He did a few of those Minion movies. He's kind of a kingmaker over there. He's kind of a really big deal. He makes a lot of money for Illumination. A lot of their hits have come from this guy. So he took a break from those films to come over here and do this, which is where we have all of our sheep, right? These CGI-heavy characters and our big voice cast, who are all really tremendous. It's got to do both things. It's based on a German book, I think it does a pretty good job of handling it, but it does end up feeling like, I don't know, I was hoping for some big emotional exposition or something really meaningful or like a great twist in the mystery. And I feel like it does all of those parts like lukewarm. Like they're all good. Few of them are great. There are some really tremendous emotional moments in there for sure. There are a couple of like big turns in the mystery, but like at some point you realize it's a lot of like sheep standing outside of windows listening and then going back to the flock and be like, you're not going to believe what I heard. And like, okay. Like it can only go so far. Like it has to remain grounded in reality while also being a talking sheep movie. And I think that stuff ends up not working too good. What does end up working is it ends up being kind of this fun, low stakes romp at the movies. And that's what I felt like I heard people telling me about this movie, that like, oh, it's just fun because it's like how movies used to be. You know what I mean? It's not some big franchise feature. It's not some great sequel. You don't need homework. It doesn't have a $300 million budget. It doesn't come with a popcorn bucket. It's just this soft, almost like a rom-com movie that came out. And like in a space where there have been so few of these, somehow Sheep Detectives ends up finding $120 million success, which is kind of tremendous and I think speaks a lot to the industry.
Right. It's got a lot going for it for, like I said, people who don't go to the movies a lot. The plot is fairly straightforward, but it's also pretty interesting. And like I said, I really appreciate it. And again, this is written by Craig Mason, who wrote The Last of Us and has done a lot of that kind of... he's written a lot of really popular things, so I was kind of surprised that he's the main person who adapted it. Yeah, it's really funny. It's really cute. We have a lot of our personalities in our sheep who they have very distinct looks and voices. That's definitely where they put the money for this stuff. So you have a lot of just memorable stuff, and it's, again, it's a PG film, so you know there's no violence, there's no like sensuality. So it's safe for everyone. I think that's the biggest appeal, is that you're not going to offend anyone. And it still manages to kind of touch on some heavy topics. There's this thing that the sheeps do where they're like, oh, this thing is unpleasant. I don't want to remember it anymore. And they all decide to just count down and they forget whatever just happened. And eventually they realize that they can't keep doing that, that you have to sit there and learn to deal with like difficult situations and feelings and work through them. And I was like, that's actually a profound lesson to be, you know, teaching young people, young viewers. So it still has some kind of more grown up elements as well.
Yeah. The death stuff is kind of earnest in a way that like, I think really does tug at the heartstrings, the way that they just forget death every time it comes around. Cause like, well, it's painful and hard, so I just don't want to do it. And slowly it's like, hey, that's how growth happens. Like that's how you grow and change. And that's necessary and important. And that's how you control where you're headed. And like that stuff's really tough and it's challenging. It's stuff you don't want to look at, but that's how you get there. And like, that's one of a few emotional messages in this movie. Yeah. Immaculate vibes. It's green and it's sunny and it's the countryside and everything's good, dog. There's a couple of little dour parts in there, but otherwise like very nice. You could have a copy of Sheep Detectives on DVD in the waiting room at a hospital or in like the nursery, like where all the parents are waiting to pick their kids up, and it would run for both audiences. You could run this for children. You could run this for senior citizens. It offends nobody. For anybody out there who's like, I don't want my movies to have a message, good news. Like Sheep Detectives is pretty soft. It doesn't have any political leanings either way. Like it doesn't get any, it doesn't ruffle any feathers. It's pretty good all around. And I think it's impressive when a movie can do that. And even have Andy and I saying, hey, pretty solid effort. I think Phil Lord and Chris Miller picked a solid script here, like to get behind. I think it's odd and it's strange that a movie like this kind of gets made now. Cause yeah, they just don't make movies like this anymore. There used to be 40 of these a year. Like in the 80s and 90s, like these were earnest swings at like what might work at the box office. You know what I mean? Is scripts just like this. And now these just don't get produced. So stuff like this and Hail Mary, even like Spider-Verse and Lego Movie are the kind of projects that those two want to be involved in. They seem to have a very particular sense of taste for what may and may not work. And this like kind of lands not necessarily alongside those, but I get why they're in the same bucket. Like I see why they wanted to get behind this. And you can see the talent behind it too, that like clearly a lot of people got a paycheck, but also I think maybe earnestly believed in what Sheep Detectives is doing. So without running out of things to say, any other thoughts or recommendations, Andy?
I think I'm ready.
Andy, would you recommend The Sheep Detectives?
Yeah, overall, like I said, it's streaming right now. It was in theaters recently. It's a sweet little movie. a whodunit with that's PG-13 that has fun animal characters and human characters. Say fun for the whole family. Take the kids. Take your parents. Take your grandparents. A good introduction to for younger viewers who, if you're looking for something a little bit that's not just like the Minions or a kiddie film, that requires a little bit more paying attention, but isn't, you know, too dangerous or anything like that. So perfect for streaming.
Yeah, a big recommendation for me. It's on Prime Video. You can watch it with any Amazon Prime subscription. A big shout out to everybody who encouraged us to watch this movie. We had a lot of people reach out. They were like, hey, have you covered it on the pod yet? Have you guys done it on Offscript? Thank you for listening. Thank you for encouraging. Thank you for sharing movies you like with us, because we get to look at them and talk about them and share them with other people through this little thing we're doing. So thank you. I really appreciate it. Sheep Detectives is a solid watch. Really enjoyed it. Check it out on Prime Video. It's available right now. And that is Offscript episode 343. Good Lord. Next week, I'm going to be honest. I'm traveling. I'm sorry. We're going to take a week off. But we're coming back so hot on July 21st. What do we got, Andy?
We're going to be taking a look at Evil Dead Burn, the latest in the Evil Dead franchise. And also, of course, Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey, which we are seeing at 7:45 in the morning, because we got IMAX 70mm tickets for that Saturday of that weekend. Super excited for that. I'm going to have to get up a little bit early, get some coffee going, maybe do some walking on the walking pad. So we're up in time for that. I'm just amazed that we got tickets for that. Some FYI releases this weekend, July 10th, is also opening Moana, the live action from Disney, starring Dwayne Johnson and others. Haven't heard a lot of great buzz about that. It might have been too soon for a remake. And also The Invite, which is Olivia Wilde's latest film, which I've heard a lot of great things about. That's about a couple that invites another couple over for dinner, and things take a turn, I guess. Don't know a lot about that film, but heard a lot of great things. That's out this July 10th. But next time, Evil Dead Burn and The Odyssey.
Yeah, I keep hearing The Invite is like all gas and it's wonderful and a great script and really fantastic. And I should come around on it, but like, I gotta travel. We'll get to that later. All right, we'll get to The Invite at some point. Like, I don't know. I got it. If I had a nickel for every time I had a movie about adults standing around in rooms and critics were like rave reviews, I'd be like, okay, yeah, sure. You know, it's a whole lot of people standing around in rooms. I'm sure the script is wonderful. It's probably great. If you like the show today, if you like what we're doing here on Offscript, if you want to see more of what we got going on, best way to do that is just subscribe to the show or like and comment. Just throw a like. If you don't want to share the show with your friends, let the algorithm do the sharing for you. All right. All you got to do is hit that like button and we will get pushed out to other people. So comment where you're able. If you like, you know, drop anything. And God, check us out on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, Facebook. That's our social media at Offscript Film Review. For audio listeners, you want to take the show on the go. We're on Spotify, Google Play, iHeartMedia, iTunes. We're on YouTube, where we're uploading every week. Big things going on YouTube. Come check out the channel. Check out our website, offscriptfilmreview.com, where you can find more interviews. And email us correspondence directly from you to us at mail@offscriptfilmreview.com, the old-fashioned way. And yeah, that's Offscript episode 343. From all of us at Offscript, the home of bold cinema, I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Thanks for watching.